They all have one common denominator from the time period that Daniels worked there.
Decker nodded. He had been looking and reading over her shoulder. Back then, all those facilities were involved in developing chemical and biological weapons of mass destruction.
It apparently all began during World War II. We didn't have those types of weapons, but Germany did. So we started researching and developing them, both the Army and the Air Force. The programs accelerated from the end of World War II through the Korean War and beyond. During that time, the U.S. and the Soviet Union made enough of the stuff to kill everyone on Earth, and that doesn't include nukes,
said Jameson as she scrolled down the screen.
But then Nixon halted all such programs at the end of the 60s. All stores of such weapons were destroyed, and the facilities that those programs operated were cleaned up and reassigned.
Only maybe some of them weren't destroyed, said Decker. And maybe there was a facility that worked on them that wasn't included in the list you just researched.
Meaning London Air Force Station?
Decker nodded. I think it was originally built not for radar array, but for production of biochemical weapons. Then the place was converted into a radar installation, even though it duplicated what the other one did near Grand Forks. Hell, maybe they added on to it at that point, to make it look like the other facility. You know, a pyramid with a golf ball on top.
Until they started using it for a secret prison. What, do people just wait around to do something secret and illegal and then just plop it here?
You're talking about the government, Alex, so anything is possible.
So is that the time bomb we're all sitting on here? WMDs?
It's a theory, but a good one. We just need to prove that it's true.
And if it is true?
We need to find the WMDs.
Oh, no sweat. We can wrap this all up by tomorrow.
When he didn't respond to her sarcasm, she glanced up at him. He was clearly lost in thought.
Are you thinking of some way to actually do that?
We'll need to alert Roby to what we found. Maybe they can get some people on it. But we have some angles to work, too.
Beginning with what?
London Air Force Station.
If they were making WMDs over there, I'm not sure I want to go there again.
But we will anyway, replied Decker. It was the next day. Jameson was driving, and Decker was staring out the window at yet another approaching storm.
Dollar for your thoughts?
Said Jameson. Not sure they're worth that much.
You seem down. I mean, I can understand that, what with our line of work, but you always seem to be able to, I don't know, rise above it.
He turned to look at her. Stan has been my brother-in-law for over 2 decades. I've spoken to him more here than I have in the last 20 years. Same with my sisters.
Well, they lived a long way away, and siblings grow up and move on with their own lives.
You have siblings. You keep in touch with them all.
I'm the oldest. It sort of comes with the territory. And not to stereotype, but girls are a little better at that than guys, at least in my experience.
Before what happened to me happened, I did keep in touch. I would call and even write letters, if you can believe that. Before Stan and Renee moved to California, I went to visit them in Colorado. I was still in college. They were pretty much still newlyweds. I helped Stan lay a brick patio in their backyard.
That's really nice, Decker.
I wasn't drafted after my senior year. I was a walk-on with the Browns. Worked my tail off and made the team. Really just as a special teams player. I was a good athlete. I was big enough and strong enough. But the NFL is a whole other level. The best of the best. I didn't have the speed or the other intangibles you needed to really be more than a journeyman. Then I was running down the field after the kickoff on opening day. And the next thing, I woke up in a hospital. Both my sisters were there. I'd been in a coma for days. Renee was holding one of my hands, and Diane the other. I didn't even notice them at first. I was looking at the weird colors on the monitor and the clock, and I thought I was losing my mind. Then I saw my sisters, and even though I knew they were my sisters, there was just something gone. I felt nothing for them. I mean nothing. He looked away. Jameson, who had clearly been stunned by this candid outpouring from her partner, finally found her voice.
You'd been through a terrible trauma, Decker, and then you had some unexpected challenges.
A nice, polite way to describe it.
But you've changed. Since the first time I met you in that courthouse back in Burlington, you're different.
I know. And that's what scares the hell out of me. He said nothing more, but just stared at the darkening skies like they would any minute starkly reveal his even darker future. Chapter 59. When they drove up to the front gate of the facility, two men in suits approached them. Jameson rolled down her window and showed her creds.
"Go right in," said one of the men. "You've been cleared through."
The gate opened and Jameson drove on.
"Roby's doing?"
she said. "When I called Roby and filled him in on what we had discovered, he said he was going to get the wheels turning for our visit here, and they were going to start making discreet inquiries about the chemical weapons piece." They parked where they had last time and got out. Jameson said,
"So where do we begin?"
"Let's try the pyramid building first. Probably the closest I'll ever get to Egypt." Another man stationed there and also wearing a suit, his eyes shielded by sunglasses, though now the dark clouds fully covered the sky, let them inside. They could see that the stone walls on the outside also constituted the interior walls. The inside was enormous. In the center of the facility was, at least Decker assumed, the park's radar apparatus that Sumter had told them about. It looked somewhat like the enormous telescopes one would see in an observatory, but with lots of other equipment surrounding it, including workstations lining the walls, with banks of darkened computers on them.
"Wow,"
said Jameson.
"This looks like something you'd see in a weird science fiction film where they're plotting how to blow up the world."
"It might not be fiction," retorted Decker.
"Gee, thanks for that comforting thought."
Decker saw only one doorway set into the far wall. "Let's go see where that leads." Multiple sets of stairs led to a lower level where Roby had previously told them the prisoners had been kept. They were cages more than prison cells, obviously improvised by the look of them.
"They probably just dumped these things in here once they decided to use this place as a jail," said Decker. "Doesn't look like a lot of thought went into it at all."
"Imprisoning and torture don't require a lot of thought. Just a lot of immoral people doing all the wrong things for all the wrong reasons,"
Jameson said forcefully.
"I can see you've given this some thought."
"In my previous life as a journalist, I did a story on the subject. It wasn't pretty."
They both noted the blood and what looked like bodily waste on the floors of the cages, and the smell of urine was strong in the air.
"Despite how disgusting this all is, I take it we won't see any congressional hearings,"
said Jameson.
"They're going to bury it all, like they told us," replied Decker. "And so long as the people behind it are punished, I'm okay with that. We have enough to deal with as a country without having this added to the pile."
"I suppose,"
said Jameson doubtfully.
"But what about the truth coming out being the cornerstone of democracy?"
He glanced at her.
"Your old journalist's antennae tingling for the truth to come out again?"
"But that's in the past. I follow orders now."
"No, it's not in the past, Alex. It's why we're here, to find the truth."
She smiled.
"I knew I liked you for a very good reason."
"If they did work on chemical and biological weapons, it must have been down here somewhere."
He eyed twin corridors that went off to the left and right.
"Do you think this place might be contaminated?"
asked Jameson suddenly.
"I mean, some of that stuff can hang around a long time."
Decker stiffened.
"I didn't really think about that. But people have been working here for decades. If the place had been contaminated, they would have shut it down. At least they should have."
"Let's hope you're right. I'm not as confident."
He led the way down the corridor on the right. After taking flights of steps down, they reached a cavernous room, nearly as large as the one containing the park system above them.
"We went down several sets of long steps to get to this point,"
noted Jameson.
"So this space must be well underground, 100 feet or more."
Decker nodded in agreement as he gazed around.
"Doesn't look like they used this when they were running the prison. And it smells moldy, too."
He walked the perimeter of the room, examining the walls and floor. In one place, the wall was lighter than the other sections. Decker looked this over and then kept moving. He stopped abruptly and turned to Jameson.
"Wait a minute. How did Ben Purdy even know that something like that had happened here? That there were chemical and biological weapons produced here?
I don't know, but we saw the research he'd done on those pages.
She tensed.
Wait a minute. What would prompt him to even do that research?
That's what I was talking about. And I think the answer is Brad Daniels.
No, Daniels was the catalyst for Kramer's coming here. He had nothing to do with Purdy.
Why do you think that? Asked Decker.
Your cardinal rule. There are no coincidences.
Well, for every rule, there is an exception. In fact, I think he did learn about it from Brad Daniels.
Based on what?
She asked. Decker pulled out Daniels's hat and pointed to another pin on there. Jameson examined it.
An anniversary event the Air Force held?
2 years ago, at Minot Air Force Base, right here in North Dakota.
But how can we know they both attended, even with that pin on his hat?
I know they did, because it was noted in Purdy's service record that he attended that very same event.
But we still can't be sure that they met there.
Which is why I'm going to call the nursing home in Williston and have it out with Brad Daniels once and for all.
Go easy on him, Decker. He's an old man.
That old man is tougher than just about any son of a bitch I've ever met, Decker groused.
But he wouldn't tell us anything before. Why would he now?
He held up the hat and smiled. Because now I've got a bargaining chip. Chapter 60. Mr. Daniels, it's Amos Decker with the FBI. Decker held the phone away from his ear as the old man started screaming at him. You son of a bitch! You give me back my hat! You're a thief! So you noticed it was gone. I take it your eyesight is better than you let on. If I were 40 years younger, I'd kick your ass! But you're not, so let's make a deal, Mr. Daniels. You answer my questions, and I guarantee that you'll get your hat back intact. What questions? Daniels barked. I told you I can't answer nothing. It's classified. Do you know what classified means, moron? What I'm going to ask you has nothing to do with classified information. I just want to ask you if you met someone at the anniversary event you attended at Minot Air Force Base. How the hell did you know about that? Daniels barked. You have a pin about it on your hat. A hat you stole? That's a felony! At most, it's a misdemeanor. And like I said, you'll get your hat back. I promise. How do I know you'll keep your word? Because like you, I took an oath to serve this country. And that oath means a lot to me, like it did to you. Go on, said a suddenly calmer Daniels. Was there someone there you met named Ben Purdy? He was a sergeant with the Air Force. Daniels didn't answer right away. Finally, he said, Is he dead too? No, but he is missing. So you did meet up with him? What the hell is going on up there? I'm trying to find that out. Did you mention to Purdy that the London facility was used to work on biological and chemical weapons? That's classified, damn it. You said nothing you asked me would make me reveal classified information. You're a big fat liar, you are. I know all about the program that went on up here and at other facilities around the country. Pine Bluff, Rocky Mountain Arsenal, Fort Detrick, Camp Detrick. At least it was back then. He fell silent. So, you've been read in, I see. I have been. I have top-secret security clearances. What does this have to do with anything? I'm not sure, but it seems that a lot of people are interested in it enough to kill other people. So it wasn't a radar facility back then? Not exactly. But you worked with radar and such. Why would they send you there if it involved working on chemical weapons? You had no expertise in that. Decker heard a long sigh, and then Daniels said, It was supposed to be a radar facility, so they had to have radar people stationed there. Otherwise, it would look funny. So I was one of those guys, you know, keeping up pretenses. Did you know that going in? I didn't know anything. I went where I was told. Did you have anything to do with the work there?
Not really. Us radar guys learned pretty quick that something was up. I mean, we weren't running a radar facility, for starters, and we had been sworn to secrecy, even beyond what you normally are. We had to sign papers and stuff. Now, we knew the commies were in a nuke race with us, but we also knew the Germans had been making chemical weapons during the big one, and we had to play catch-up. That wasn't a huge secret. So when we started seeing some of the stuff being brought into London, well, I saw enough boxes marked with skulls and crossbones to know what was going on. And then they recruited us to do some stuff with what they were doing. I don't mean making the shit, but I'd seen some of the labs they had down there.
You mean in the lower level of the pyramid building? Decker asked.
Yeah. They usually didn't want us down there. We mainly worked on security and keeping up the facility, stuff like that. But occasionally, as time went on, we were sent down there to do some tasks. And we had to put on masks and special suits and crap like that.
Did you see any of the stuff that came out of there?
Yeah, we helped put it in these special storage rooms in these bomb-proof containers. Scared the crap out of me, I can tell you. They had warning signs all over the place. Highly toxic. Do not touch. Never take your masks and goggles off. Stuff like that. Even with that, some of the guys got sick. I mean, inadvertently. They never tested stuff on anybody. Nothing like that. This is the good old U.S. of A. We don't do that shit.
Anything else?
Daniels didn't answer.
Mr. Daniels, anything else? It's important.
Daniels didn't respond, and Decker decided to just let the silence linger. He wanted Daniels to feel the moment, to let him understand that something momentous was happening, and he could be an integral part of it, if he would just open up.
Daniels said, "Then, sometime in the late 60s, it all went away. They closed up shop, and then we started using the facility as a radar station. I got to do what I was trained to do. It was really exciting stuff. We were protecting our country from the commies."
So they took all the stuff away.
That's right.
Now, can you tell me about your talk with Purdy, the young man you met at the event?
He was a nice young guy, stationed where I had been. He had proper security clearances. We had a lot in common. We hit it off. We had a couple drinks, even. Made me feel young again.
And then what?
And then, well, I told him about some of the stuff that we had done up there.
And he was interested?
Yeah, asked a million questions. I answered what I could.
Did you ever tell him about Mary Rice?
No, I never did.
How did you leave it with him?
I didn't leave it anyway with him. If he followed up on any of it, I didn't know nothing about that.
He paused.
You said he's missing. He was a right nice young fellow. Proud to serve his country. You think he's okay?
I'm hoping he is, Mr. Daniels. But in my business, sometimes hope isn't good enough.
Decker filled Jameson in as they left the facility.
So Ben Purdy did learn about the WMDs from the same source that Irene Kramer did, Brad Daniels.
Yep, replied Decker. But we still have a lot to figure out.
As they passed the land ringing the installation, Jameson pointed out a large John Deere combine that was kicking up dust in an adjacent field.
Do you think the brothers have anything to do with this?
I can't say one way or another, answered Decker.
Jameson pointed in the other direction.
At least that's a positive.
Decker looked in that direction where there was an operating oil rig.
What?
The pipe over there. No methane gas flare. They must be piping the gas out instead of wasting it, or maybe separating the bad stuff out like Stan was talking about.
Will miracles never cease? Replied Decker, smiling.
His phone buzzed the next instant. Decker said,
Hey, Kelly, what's up?
Decker, we have a situation here, said Kelly, the strain quite clear in his voice.
What situation?
Stuart McClellan has been found dead.
Dead? How? Where?
In a car at one of his storage facilities. Looks like he committed suicide.
Give me the address, and we'll be there as fast as we can.
Chapter 61.
It was the perfect place to off yourself, thought Decker as they drove up to the old wooden building that was about the size of five large barns melded together. In a fenced-in area were remnants of what looked to be broken pieces of drilling equipment. Three police squad cars and Kelly's SUV were parked by the entrance. Yellow police tape fluttered and crackled in the stiffening breeze that heralded the storm system marching on them. Kelly met them outside and led them into the building. In the center of the sprawling space was a late-model black Cadillac sedan with its driver's side door open. They eyed the hose running from the tailpipe to the rear passenger window, which was open a crack, allowing the hose to fit through. Kelly pointed to the driver's side door.
We opened the door to check the body.
Decker and Jameson stepped forward. Stuart McClellan lay across the front seat, his head on the console separating the front seats, with his feet on the floorboard. His eyes were closed, and his face was the trademark cherry red. Inhaling a tank full of exhaust fumes caused carbon monoxide atoms to piggyback on red blood cells, jettisoning oxygen atoms in the process. The cells traveled throughout the body, but arrived at their destinations without the oxygen needed to keep the body functioning, resulting in both death and the cherry red color.
He suffocated, clearly, noted Kelly.
Decker said,
Any signs of a struggle? Defensive wounds? Bruising to the body to show that he was knocked out and then placed here?
We haven't done a full exam of the body, but we've found nothing like that, said Kelly. No obvious wounds and no blood. We're going to dust for prints, of course, but we don't expect that to yield much. The guy obviously killed himself.
Jameson said,
There was no one else here, no security cameras to show any activity?
No and no, replied Kelly. McClellan's had this place forever, but it's mostly a junkyard now. No one works out here anymore, and there are no security cameras because there's nothing of value. Hell, he probably wished someone had taken some of this junk.
Did he leave a note?
Asked Jameson.
Not that we found, no. But a lot of suicides don't.
Does Shane know?
Asked Jameson.
I've left a message. I'm sure I'll hear back.
When's the last time someone saw McClellan? Asked Decker.
He and Hugh Dawson were seen last night having dinner together at Maddie's. Couldn't believe that when I heard it. I mean, I don't think those two have even shared a civil word, much less a dinner.
Well, McClellan owns the restaurant now, or did,
replied Jameson.
Come again, said a surprised Kelly.
Might as well tell him, said Decker.
Tell me what, said Kelly.
Jameson said,
Dawson was selling all his businesses to McClellan, including the restaurant.
The hell you say?
They were probably there celebrating the deal closing,
added Jameson.
Kelly looked stunned.
Why in the world would he do that? And how did you find out?
We happened upon them while they were meeting,
said Jameson vaguely.
As to the reason for the sale, Dawson basically just wanted to cash in and get out. At least that's what he told us.
And what about Caroline?
Her father said she'd be fine with it.
Kelly looked angry.
No way in hell she'll be fine about it. She's worked her ass off for all this. And Maddie's was her baby. This is going to kill her.
This outburst surprised Jameson, and her expression showed it. She said,
I know you said you were really tight with her growing up.
Kelly calmed, looking sheepish.
Look, any guy around here that wasn't in love with Caroline Dawson needed to have his head examined, and I was no exception.
But that was high school,
said Jameson.
Kelly glanced at her. Sometimes time doesn't make a difference in how you feel about someone.
He suddenly refocused.
But that's neither here nor there. So we got either a murder or a suicide here, and we need to figure out which it is.
Decker ran his gaze over the caddy's interior.
Any signs that someone else was recently here? Tire marks? Another vehicle seen coming or going during the relevant times?
Nope, nothing like that. But considering everything that's happened so far, I think we need to go slow on this. Because while it sure looks like a suicide, for the life of me, I can't imagine what his motive would be. The facts are that McClellan is rich as shit, just bought out his rival, and had this entire town in his pocket.
maybe a lifelong dream of his for all I know. So right after completing that, and maybe, like Alex suggested, celebrating his triumph, he drives out here and sucks on a tailpipe to finish off the best day of his life? Tell me how that makes sense.
I agree with you, said Decker.
Who's doing the post?
Asked Jameson.
The guy who came up to do Walt's isn't available. Let me call someone in from the bureau to do it, said Decker.
I appreciate that.
Decker pulled a pair of latex gloves from his jacket pocket, slapped them on, and leaned into the caddy. He felt one of the dead man's arms.
He's clearly in rigor. So roughly 12 hours or more. Ambient temp in here is average. But if he burned through a full tank of gas after he died, it might have gotten pretty hot in here.
Definitely could have sped up the rigor initiation and body decomp,
pointed out Jameson. Kelly said,
That's going to be important because we need to establish alibis. So, any idea where Hugh Dawson is?
You're thinking Hugh had something to do with this?
If he was the last person to see McClellan before he died, I have some questions to ask the man. And the sooner, the better.
Chapter 62. One phone call found Hugh Dawson at his home. Kelly, Decker, and Jameson arranged to meet him out there that night. They didn't tell him why. The maid led them to his office, where he rose from behind his desk to greet them. He looked anxiously at Kelly.
Is it true? Is Stuart really dead?
How'd you hear about that? Said Kelly imperturbably.
Hell, it's all over. My maid told me. She heard it from her boyfriend, who works for McClellan.
It is true, said Decker.
How'd he die?
Decker said, He was found dead in his car. Looks like carbon monoxide poisoning. The same way your wife died, he added, drawing sharp looks from both Jameson and Kelly.
Dawson plopped back down in his chair. Holy Lord.
We understand you had dinner with McClellan last night, said Kelly.
That's right, at Maddie's.
Did he pick the place?
Asked Jameson.
He glanced at Kelly.
I know about the deal, Kelly said.
Okay, to answer your question, it was his idea. Now that he owns it.
And have you told Caroline yet? Asked Kelly sternly.
I'm going to meet with her and tell her.
Can I ask why you sold out? Said Kelly.
Jameson said you told her you just wanted to cash out. Last time I was here, you were upbeat about things, buying properties. Caroline opened her restaurant and everything. I also talked about the downsides to fracking, and I'm just tired, Joe. Been doing this for nearly 40 years.
What are you going to do? Kelly asked.
Buying a place in France, only a lot bigger than the one I had before. Got a guest house for Caroline large enough for the kiddies when they come along.
I wouldn't count on that, said Kelly. You basically sold out her life from under her.
I don't see it that way, he said crossly.
Then you're choosing not to see.
I know you were very close growing up. Hell, there was a time there when I thought you two would walk down the aisle. But this is none of your damn business.
Okay, then let me get back to what is my business. When was the last time you saw McClellan?
When we left the restaurant.
Give us the details.
It was around 11. He got in his car and I got in mine. I drove back here.
Can anyone corroborate that? Asked Decker.
No. Everybody here had gone home long before then. It was just me.
So nobody can vouch for your whereabouts? Asked Kelly.
Wait a minute. Are you implying? Why the hell would I want to kill Stuart McClellan? He just paid me a great deal of money.
Jameson interjected.
We're just trying to learn about timelines and alibis, Mr. Dawson. It's all routine.
Well, it sure doesn't come across as routine. Where was Stuart found? At his place?
No, said Kelly.
And you said it was carbon monoxide poisoning? Could it have been an accident, like Maddie?
Decker said, No, it was clearly deliberate. Can you think of any reason why he would commit suicide?
Dawson considered this for a few moments. Not a single one.
He stood to make a great deal more money now that he had combined his businesses with mine. He could merge the back-end offices, eliminate redundancies, and increase his cash flow. He was sitting pretty, so why would he kill himself?
Then it looks like murder, said Decker. Unless we're missing something, do you know why anyone would want to kill him?
Dawson looked warily at him. I don't like making accusations against anybody.
Let's call them suggested persons of interest, said Decker. It goes no further than this room, but if you have names, we can check them out.
Stewart was a hard-nosed businessman. He drove tough bargains, left some with nothing.
These people have names?
Asked Jameson. None of them are still around here, and the one that I might have named has been dead about a year. He paused and looked uncertain.
What? Said Decker quickly.
Look, I like the boy fine, I really do. Fought for his country and all, but Stewart was merciless to him.
You mean Shane? Said Kelly.
I know you were buds.
We were friends growing up, and we're still friends, but not as tight as before. Do you have anything more concrete than his abusing Shane?
Not really, no. But you asked, and so that's what my answer is.
And Shane would inherit his father's fortune, of course,
said Jameson. As far as I know, you'd have to check with the lawyers on that. Stewart could have made a will leaving it to anybody he wanted.
But if he did that and Shane didn't know, he could still have a motive for murdering his father, pointed out Decker.
I don't think I know anyone less in love with money and business than Shane, noted Kelly.
Shane told us you and he weren't as close as you once were,
noted Jameson.
And you just said the same thing.
High school was high school. Then life came along. We went our separate ways. But I knew the guy back then, and that guy hasn't changed. Hell, he could have stayed here and sat on his ass and let his father pay him. But he joined the army and risked his life for his country. He came back with medals, and he never talks about any of it. Dawson smiled. You two were the best football players this town ever turned out.
Decker played for the Cleveland Browns,
said Jameson.
After starting for Ohio State.
Wow, said Kelly. That is damn impressive. Well, you're certainly big enough, said Dawson, eyeing Decker's huge frame.
Yeah, if it were only about size, I'd be in the Hall of Fame, noted Decker wryly.
He looked at Kelly.
We still have to check it out.
I know we do, said Kelly brusquely. And I'll keep an open mind, but I think that's the wrong tree to bark up.
Well, if Shane has an alibi, then that will settle it,
said Jameson. Kelly eyed Dawson. You might want to talk to your daughter sooner rather than later. You don't want her finding out about the sale from somebody else. That would not be good.
You let me worry about that, Joe, snapped Dawson.
So you're going to live in France with Caroline?
That's right.
Kelly smiled grimly. And what, maybe she'll meet some Frenchman, fall in love, and have a bunch of kids?
Well, that's up to her, not me.
And if she doesn't want to go, will you give her a stake to start her own business?
I don't know. I'm not sure I'm ready to be separated from her. I lost her mother. I don't want to lose her.
Well, be prepared to do just that, said Kelly.
She can start another restaurant in France, said Dawson dismissively. She was ready to move last time. What's the difference now?
Well, I guess you'll find out one way or another, said Kelly.
What do you care? Demanded Dawson. Don't tell me you're still in love with her.
It's not a crime to care about somebody, Hugh, even if they make decisions you don't agree with, especially if they're family. But maybe you don't think that way. I mean, look at what happened to your son.
Dawson's face grew red.
You can just get the hell out of here.
Don't worry. We were leaving anyway.
Chapter 63.
Of all the dumb, short-sighted things to do, groused Kelly as they were driving back to town, he expects his daughter, who he just sold down the river, to up and move to France with him and leave everything and everybody she's ever known behind.
I agree that it's both presumptuous and really insensitive,
said Jameson. She looked at Decker.
What do you think?
I was wondering whether Hugh Dawson could have been involved in McClellan's death.
That wasn't what we were talking about,
said Jameson. Well, it's what I want to talk about, but I don't see a motive.
Kelly said, Shane probably has a motive, at least on paper, but he doesn't care about inheriting a fortune, and if he were going to kill his old man, he'd just shoot him.
You'd be surprised how many people start to care when they're actually close to getting the money, noted Decker. But money isn't the only reason to kill someone. I can imagine Stuart made Shane's life a hell on earth.
But Stuart's always been like that with Shane. Why all of a sudden would it make him kill the guy?
That's what they pay us to figure out, retorted Decker. Did you reach Shane? How'd he take the news?
I met with him before we went to see Hugh. Unless he's a world-class actor, he had nothing to do with it.
Did he have any ideas about who might want to kill Stuart?
Not that he volunteered.
Did he say what he was going to do?
Asked Jameson. No, he walked out in a daze, really. Jameson said,
Dawson got really upset with you at the end when you mentioned his son, Junior.
None of that was right. Junior should still be alive, leading a good, full life. Instead, he's 6 feet under because of that guy.
Was it really that bad?
Asked Jameson.
It was worse. Decker continued, What I found curious was McClellan died by carbon monoxide poisoning.
You mean like Caroline's mother?
Noted Jameson.
Exactly. Tell me exactly what you saw at the scene of Maddie's death, said Decker, looking at Kelly.
Kelly took a few moments to marshal his thoughts.
The car had slid off the road. There was an embankment there. The snow was about 3 feet deep at that point. The vehicle was leaning at about a 30-degree angle. The tailpipe had gotten pushed up against the embankment. It was partially bent, and snow and dirt had gotten lodged in there, totally clogged.
But why wouldn't she have gotten out of the car and checked?
Asked Jameson.
She naturally would have wanted to see how she was stuck so she could get free somehow.
Exactly what I thought. And the answer was, when she slid off the road sideways, the brute force smashed her up against the window. She hit her head and was unconscious. There was a hematoma on the side of her head, and a bit of blood and other trace on the window where she struck it.
And the airbags didn't deploy?
Asked Jameson.
We checked that. Had an expert come in. He said in that situation, the airbags probably would not have deployed. And it was an older model Jeep SUV. It didn't have side airbag curtains anyway. And the seat harness would not have necessarily prevented her from being thrown to the side. There were no other signs of anyone else being there, though the snowfall would have covered any traces. She had cash and credit cards in her purse, and still had her wedding ring and a pair of diamond studs on. So robbery wasn't a motive, and we could never find any reason for anyone to intentionally kill her. And besides, how would anyone know she would have been out in the blizzard? She only went out because Alice Pritchard called her when she lost power. The autopsy came back with an accident as the manner of death, and carbon monoxide poisoning as the cause.
Who called overseas to tell them she'd died?
Said Jameson.
Actually, that was me. I was in charge of the investigation. Hardest call I've ever had to make. As soon as I told Caroline, she started sobbing. I couldn't make out another word after that. And I felt bad because I couldn't do anything to help her. I just felt so helpless, Kelly said miserably. They dropped him off at the police station and watched him go inside. Jameson said somberly,
He's still very much in love with Caroline Dawson.
Yes, he is. And I wish him luck, but if I was Kelly, I wouldn't hold my breath. I don't think she's going to suddenly run into his arms.
As they pulled away, Jameson said,
But this may very well have nothing to do with why we're up here. Figuring out the time bomb comment by Ben Purdy, that has to be our focus.
Our focus is finding out who killed Irene Kramer.
But isn't one connected to the other?
Not necessarily.
As they pulled in front of their hotel, Baker hailed them from the street. Decker rolled down the passenger window and said,
Stan, what's up?
Was just coming to see you. That photo you gave me of the dead woman?
Irene Kramer, what about it?
I asked around about anyone that might have, you know, been with her.
And did you find anybody?
Three guys. All oil field workers.
And?
And they all said that they hadn't had sex with her.
So what did they do with her?
Asked Jameson. She bought them food and drinks.
That's interesting,
said Jameson. Decker said, but it makes sense. Why get into bed with strangers if she could get the info she wanted by springing for food and booze? Be a lot easier for her.
Boy, I hear you on that,
said Jameson a bit too quickly. When Decker glanced at her, she blushed and looked away. Baker said,
as I was saying, she bought them food and drinks and asked a lot of questions.
Questions about what?
That Air Force installation.
But why ask oil workers about a military base?
Beats the hell out of me. She might have talked to some of the guys who worked there before the Air Force pulled out.
And I never saw any of the Vector guys come into town, so she might not have been able to ask them.
What sort of questions did she ask? Decker wanted to know.
Anything suspicious they might have seen, whether they knew the history of the facility? And she asked about the auctioning off of the land around the facility.
Decker nodded thoughtfully.
Now that is interesting. Anything else?
That's about it. Hope it helps.
Thanks, Stan.
Baker moved off and Decker rolled his window back up.
Did that help?
Asked Jameson, who had listened to the whole exchange.
I don't know. I can understand her wanting to know about the military base and the land around it. I mean, that's where Daniels worked, after all.
But it's still puzzling,
conceded Jameson.
Everything about this damn case is puzzling.
Chapter 64. Later that night, Decker and Jameson were summoned once more to a meeting with Blue Man. Roby and Reel picked them up outside their hotel and drove them to a home about 15 miles outside of town. As they pulled up to the house, Decker said,
"Looks abandoned."
"That's what we like about this place,"
said Reel.
"So many free spaces to meet."
"That's the only thing we like about this place," added Roby. "Otherwise, it's turning out to be more dangerous than the Middle East."
They were led inside, where Blue Man was sitting in a wooden-backed chair, dressed in a perfectly tailored suit and looking like he had just started his day.
"We have some things of interest to share," he began. "Patrick McIntosh and Mark Sumter are currently lawyering up, if only to enter guilty pleas."
"And Vector?"
"They should be permanently barred from future defense contracting, along with all their executives."
"But will that actually happen?"
"We'll see. Washington, D.C. is full of successful second acts, but the uniforms involved in this are going to take a tumble. At least the ones who can't find a chair to sit in before the music stops will."
"Anything else?" asked Decker.
"For your purposes, something far more important and ominous."
"Let's hear it."
"It may mean nothing, or it may mean everything, but we've been getting some curious chatter from the Middle East lately."
"What sort of chatter?"
"The sort that we do not like to get. We often get enhanced communication activity when something significant is going down. It happened before 9/11, but no one registered it. Now we take these occurrences very seriously."
"Is there any indication where it might be coming from?"
asked Jameson.
"Not precisely, but from what we can tell, there is a nexus to this country."
"What does that mean?"
"Nothing good, I'm afraid."
"What can we do about it?"
asked Jameson.
"We need to solve this thing faster rather than slower. Time is not on our side."
"You've said that before, and we're working as fast as we can."
"Then we must work faster."
Decker stared down at him.
"Do you know what was going on at London AFS decades ago? And it had nothing to do with radar or prisoners. Tell me."
"They were making biochemical weapons,"
said Jameson.
Blue Man nodded and said, "That was before my time, though I knew of the past military efforts in that regard. But those programs were ended, and all stockpiles destroyed."
"Maybe nobody told the folks over at London."
"And this information came from?"
"An old man in a nursing home named Brad Daniels. He worked there back then. He saw things, and he knew both Ben Purdy and Irene Kramer.
We placed a security guard at the facility to look after him.
And Daniels told Kramer and Purdy about this past work?
Yes.
And the relevance today?
If people who knew about it are dying, there must be some relevance. Otherwise, what's the point?
What do you think?
If the stockpiles weren't destroyed, where might they be?
We were at the facility and didn't see anything, but we didn't come close to searching the whole place.
Noted Jameson. Perhaps it would be a good idea to get a team in to more thoroughly go through it, said Blue Man. As discreetly as possible.
I think that would be a great idea, said Decker.
Then we will make that happen. Now, Purdy was transferred out of the facility, so if the stockpile is still there, I wonder what he was going to do about it. It's not like he could have gone back to London AFS, and it also makes me wonder what Kramer's plan was. What could she possibly think she could do about a weapons stockpile at an Air Force facility? She couldn't go near the place.
It doesn't make much sense, agreed Decker.
But if this is connected to the increased chatter from the Middle East, then it makes sense to somebody,
pointed out Jameson.
Then those people must be here right now, said Decker.
Roby said,
The guys who came after me were a mix of folks, but they could have been hired by others. They looked the mercenary type. Same with the ones chasing you to that barn.
Possibly, said Decker.
If these people want the stockpiles, assuming they actually exist, they must want to smuggle them out of the country, said Blue Man.
Or use them here, said Decker.
Which was my next comment, said Blue Man. Any indication from this Daniels exactly what sort of biochem weapons we're talking about?
Only that they're classified, and he'll take them to the grave, said Decker.
But Decker,
said Jameson.
Remember, Daniels said he told Purdy because Purdy was military and had security clearances. And he opened up to you more on the phone, not just because you had his hat, but because you told him you had high-level security clearances.
She glanced at Blue Man.
If you all were to talk to him, he might open up even more. I mean, you can clearly receive classified information.
Blue Man looked at Roby and Real. Attend to that, right away.
We can give you the details,
said Jameson. As they were dropping Decker and Jameson off back at the hotel, Roby said to Decker,
While we're seeing this old guy, you all are on your own.
Jameson patted her holstered Glock and said,
We'll be careful. From what I've seen so far, you'll have to be more than careful,
said Real.
Good luck.
Chapter 65.
Any activity?
Said Real, who drove while Roby rode shotgun on the way down to Williston.
Nothing so far. If we picked up a tail, they're good.
Well, so far they have been.
How much further?
20 clicks.
Read the service record on Bradley Daniels, said Roby. Sounds like a real patriot. Purple, bronze, DFC, and the Airman's Medal. Well over 100 bombing missions in the European and Pacific theaters. Shot down twice. Sat in a life raft with 3 other crew members for a month in the Pacific before they got picked up by a Navy destroyer. Then got right back in the saddle.
Like you said, a real patriot.
Roby glanced in the side view and saw what he had seen for the last hour. Nothing. And he wasn't pleased by that. None of this felt right to him. It was well after 11 by the time they got to the nursing home and past visiting hours, but their federal badges intimidated the night supervisor so much, he led them directly to Daniels' room and then fled. The old man was fast asleep in his bed. The light was off in his room, and Roby debated whether to turn it on. He finally opted not to. They drew near the bed, one on each side.
Mr. Daniels?
Real said gently, before touching the man's shoulder. He started, and his eyes opened, then closed, then opened and stayed that way.
Who the hell are you?
He said, blinking rapidly and sitting up slightly. Roby and Real held out their creds and official badges.
We're with the intel community, said Roby.
Turn on a damn light so I can see.
Real turned on the overhead light and Daniel scrutinized the badges and cred packs.
We were told you couldn't see very well,
said Roby.
Yeah, well, I let people think that for my own reasons.
Okay.
These look real,
he finally said, handing them back. That's because they are.
What do you want with me?
London AFS,
said Real. Daniels lay back on his pillow.
I already talked to the feds. That big fella, FBI. He took my hat, the son of a bitch.
Real reached into her jacket pocket, pulled out the hat, and handed it to him.
And he asked us to return it.
Daniels looked pleased by this and said,
Well, at least he's a man of his word.
Roby said,
Ben Purdy, you told him more than you told Decker. We've been ordered here to get the rest of the story.
Why?
It's become relevant again, sir,
said Real.
You don't have to call me sir.
I do it out of respect. Purple, bronze, distinguished flying cross, airman's medal, you more than earned it.
Daniels blinked again, and his eyes grew watery.
Everybody I served with is long since dead. My wife's dead. So are my kids. Nobody left except my grandkids and their kids, and they got their own lives. Sucks being old and alone. I just sit in here rotting away, waiting for the end.
Real glanced at Roby and said to Daniels,
You should be at a VA facility. You'd find a lot more in common with the folks there than you probably do here.
Daniels looked excited.
You can make that happen?
Roby said, If that's what you want, sir. They helped Daniels to sit up straighter.
What do you want to know?
What exactly did you tell Ben Purdy?
I told him the truth. Everything.
Which was?
Said Real. The power in the facility went out. Every room, every inch. Panicked cries were heard all over the nursing home. Roby's and Real's weapons came out. Real covered the door, and Roby closed the window curtains, after gently pressing Daniels flat onto the bed and whispering into his ear,
Stay right there, and don't move.
Daniels gave one curt nod, and then froze. The sounds of footsteps could be heard rushing along the hall. Real poked her head out and saw nurses and other personnel running around. The night supervisor raced up to the door and said, We don't know what happened. Everything just went black, and our backup generator didn't kick on, and two big trucks just pulled up in front.
Call the cops. Do it now. Tell them you have a mass shooting event going down.
We do?
You do. Go.
He ran off looking terrified. Real looked at Roby.
Two big trucks?
Who are they?
Whispered Daniels from his bed.
We got this, sir,
said Real. She eyed the wheelchair and then looked at Roby.
This room is ground zero, they have to know.
He nodded. They slipped over to the bed, gently lifted Daniels up, and placed him in the wheelchair. Roby pushed it while Real led the way. They reached the doorway. Real poked her head out and gave the all clear. They turned and moved quickly to the left, away from the front doors. Real slipped another pistol out of her second holster. Both guns had laser scopes. She had already put on a pair of ND optics, as had Roby. The darkness to both of them was now represented as daylight. The problem was, their opponents would no doubt have the same technology. Roby pushed the wheelchair with one hand and held his pistol in the other. They disappeared down the hallway. 30 seconds later, the doors to the nursing home were forced open. A barrage of armed men did not storm in. There was a whizzing sound as the motorized stainless steel robot rolled along on tubeless tires. Its laser eye swept across the hall, comparing what it was seeing with the building layout stored in its database. It turned right and accelerated. There it ran into the off-duty police officer that Decker had engaged to look after Daniels. His pistol was pointed at the robot, his flashlight beam reflecting off the thing's metal sides.
What the hell? The man exclaimed.
He started to lower his weapon as the laser eye ran over him and held on the weapon. The next moment, the guard looked down at his chest where a dart was now sticking out. His eyes rolled back in his head, and he fell to the floor. The robot whirled on, neatly navigating around the fallen man. It reached Daniels' room. The laser hit all four corners of the room and then drew and held on the empty bed.
The robot rolled forward, and a tiny probe extended from its front side. This probe hit the sheets and ran its tiny metallic head over it. Information flashed back to the sensor pack in the robot's brain, and confirmation was made. The probe receded but did not fully return to the cavity from which it had emerged. The robot turned and headed back out as the probe swiveled from side to side, drawing in myriad scents in its path, as it searched for only one, that of Brad Daniels. It turned right and left, and then stopped at a closed door. The probe twitched like the nose on a scent hound, and a red light illuminated on the front of the robot's steel wall. The robot retreated about a foot, a portal opened on the front of it, and stabilizers shot out from its sides and gripped the floor, like a construction crane would employ to keep upright and balanced. The next moment, the round fired from the portal smashed into the door, and the force of the impact caused it to topple inward. Through the smoke emerged Riel. She saw the robot. Her gaze ran over its contours. She raised her weapon and placed three incendiary rounds with explosive kickers right into the thing's hide, with one round impacting the machine's laser eye. The laser eye went out. The rounds performed as they were engineered, and the robot disappeared behind a thick cloud of smoke. Riel heard the alarming screech of a timer and threw herself back into the room, right as the robot's fail-safe counter hit zero. The blast collapsed the walls of the room Riel had leapt back into. When the smoke cleared, sirens could be heard. The two big trucks that had been parked in front of the nursing home, and from which the attack robot had been launched, were long gone. Inside the room, a coughing and sputtering Roby and Riel slowly rose from the remains of the shattered room. They were alive only because they had taken cover behind a large metal storage unit standing against one wall. As they gazed around, their collective eyes caught and held on Daniels. He was still in his wheelchair, but he hung limply to the side. His head was bleeding, and his breaths were shallow. A section of the ceiling had fallen on him. Riel raced over to him and felt for his pulse.
Really weak.
Roby cleared the debris away and pushed him out of the room and down the hall, toward the front entrance. Riel was right next to him.
If he dies,
she began. Then we've lost, Roby finished for her. Chapter 66.
He's in a coma, said Roby. They don't know if he's going to make it, but he's a tough old bird. My money's on him.
It was the following evening, and he was sitting in the back seat of Jameson's SUV. Decker was in the passenger seat. Riel had gone to stay with Daniels at the hospital.
A robot?
Said Jameson.
They sent a freaking robot?
A killing machine, said Roby. Didn't expect to see it at a nursing home in North Dakota. So we don't know what he told Purdy, said Decker. He was just about to tell us when everything went to hell. We keep swinging and missing, said Decker, and we're getting down to our last outs.
A text appeared on his phone, and he looked down at it.
The ME just completed the post on McClellan, and he has some interesting findings.
Let's go hear what they are,
said Jameson.
Roby opened the truck door and climbed out. I'd like to remain in the background. Loop me in later.
20 minutes after leaving Roby, they stared down at the naked body of Stuart McClellan. Joe Kelly had joined them at the funeral home. McClellan had been professionally sliced and diced by an ME provided by the FBI. Tom Reynolds was a stern-looking gent in his late 50s with a military haircut, and his manner was no nonsense. But there was a twinkle in his eyes that perhaps evinced the interesting development he had mentioned in his text.
What do you have? Said Decker.
Death was certainly by carbon monoxide poisoning. Tissue samples presented classic microscopic hemorrhaging, and dead tissue throughout. Congestion and swelling of the brain, spleen, liver, and kidneys. The skin is obviously flushed, another classic sign, and the blood was a cherry red, a further telltale sign.
So it was suicide, then, said Kelly. No, it's not, said Decker, as he closely eyed Reynolds. Something that straightforward would not have prompted you to text me about some interesting findings.
Correct, said Reynolds. Do you know what TTX is?
Kelly shook his head, but Decker said,
Tetrodotoxin. It's a powerful neurotoxin.
Reynolds nodded.
Nasty stuff. It stops nerve conduction between the brain and body by, in part, shutting down sodium channels. A tiny bit paralyzes the muscles needed to breathe and the heart to keep pumping blood. It's lethal whether ingested, inhaled, or absorbed into the skin, like through a cut. Takes about 6 hours to fully take effect. Once it stops the diaphragm, you're dead. It's one of the deadliest substances on the planet. Only seen it one other time in my career, on the other side of the world.
And yet here it shows up in London, North Dakota, said Decker.
How did you find it?
Asked Jameson. Reynolds led them over to a highly complex-looking device.
I always bring this baby with me. Never know when it might come in handy. There were certain puzzling elements that I saw in the brain, the diaphragm, and the heart that made me suspicious. Made me think that something neurological was going on that could not be explained away simply by the carbon monoxide. They were slight, but I have enough experience for warning bells to go off. So I ran a test on some urine in the body, and there it was, clear as day.
Where the hell does someone get this TTX? Said Kelly.
It's found in marine life, replied Reynolds. Most principally in the pufferfish. The pufferfish is a Japanese delicacy. Most TTX deaths are accidental and take place because of improperly prepared pufferfish. If the organs containing the toxin are damaged or not completely removed, that dish might be the last one you ever eat. Me, I'd stick with chicken nuggets. They'll eventually kill you, but it'll take decades.
He grinned. Decker did not smile back.
Was it ingested, inhaled, or absorbed? He said.
If I had to make an educated guess, I'd say ingested.
So it might have been in something he drank.
Yes.
But why poison a guy and then kill him with carbon monoxide? Asked Kelly.
To incapacitate him and get him into the car,
replied Jameson.
That way it looks like a suicide.
She looked at the machine that Reynolds had used to find the poison.
And without that, we'd probably never have known. Walt Southern for sure would never have found it.
And a murder would have been missed, added Decker.
He glanced at Reynolds.
You said you'd handled a case of TTX before. Where was that exactly?
The Vic was found in a hotel room in Brisbane.
Brisbane, Australia?
Pufferfish are found in those waters, and those in Asia. They're not indigenous to American waters.
They thanked Reynolds and walked back outside.
Australia, said Decker again, looking thoughtful.
What about it? Said Kelly.
Hugh Dawson lives there part of the year, right? During the winters here.
Kelly looked taken aback.
Okay, but we already went over this. What would the motive be? He just made a ton of money off McClellan.
I don't know what the motive might be. I'm just saying he had the means and the opportunity. And I don't like coincidences. And here we have a big one.
Jameson said,
namely, a very rare poison that is found in fish in waters off Australia, and a person here who lives there part of the time.
And the opportunity comes from the fact that he was one of the last people to see McClellan alive, and he has no alibi for the time he was killed, added Decker.
But you'd think he'd have tried to come up with an alibi, remarked Kelly. I mean, the TOD on carbon monoxide poisoning is never going to be to the minute. He could have stuck the guy in the car and then gone someplace where there were other people to see him.
But he probably assumed it would never be seen as anything other than a suicide, countered Decker. So why bother with an alibi?
Kelly didn't look convinced by this, but he said,
look, I know this toxin stuff casts a whole new light on things. There has to be more to it than suicide. I'll agree with you on that. So you want to go talk to Hugh again?
Yeah. And right now would be a good time. And what about Shane? Asked Decker.
We checked his alibi. At all relevant times, he was out of town getting fracking supplies, a good 5 hours from here. People where he was confirmed it. I told you he had nothing to do with it.
Well, that's something, said Decker.
Joe!
They turned to see Caroline Dawson striding toward them,
a fierce look on her features.
"Oh boy, she does not look happy," said the detective nervously.
She reached them, and she stood face to face with Kelly.
"You son of a bitch!"
"What did I do?" he said, taking a step back.
"My father sold out to McClellan everything, and you knew all about it. And you didn't tell me? I thought we were friends."
"Caroline, look, you have to understand."
He looked desperately at Decker for help. Decker said,
"We were the ones to find out, and then we told Joe."
Caroline didn't take her eyes off Kelly.
"So you did know. Just say it. You did know."
"Yes, I did."
"And Maddie's, too? That's gone as well?"
"Yes. Look, I was going to tell you, but your father said..."
"Thanks for nothing."
She slapped him, turned, and strode off. Kelly rubbed his cheek where she had hit him.
"Did I mention that she has a temper?"
"Boy, I would not want to be her father,"
said Jameson.
"Speaking of, let's go talk to him right now," said Decker. "There might be nothing left of him by the time Caroline finishes with him. We need to beat her to it."
Chapter 67. On the drive out, Decker asked Kelly,
"What made Shane come back here?"
Kelly eyed him.
"This was his hometown."
"I understand that he was close to his mother, but she had died by then, correct?"
"She had, yeah."
"And he didn't really care for his father. So why come back here and work for the guy?"
"Why don't you ask him?"
"Because I'm asking you. You're his friend."
"What does it matter why he came back?"
"Right now, everything matters." Kelly sat up straighter and stared out the window.
"Shane never talked about the war with me. I only found out from other guys he served with. There were a couple that visited him here. We all went out, had some drinks, ate a bunch of red meat, and watched some football. Guy stuff, you know."
"And what did they say?"
asked Jameson.
"That Shane was really brave, that he was a good leader, that he cared about his guys more than he cared about himself. He was a ranger, you know."
"No, I didn't know that,"
said Jameson.
"Yeah, he was a sergeant when he came out. He could have stayed in and worked his way up higher, I guess, but he didn't."
"Maybe he wanted to see someone here," said Decker suggestively. Kelly continued to look out the window.
"If you're thinking of Caroline, I won't disagree with you."
"But it seems unrequited,"
said Jameson.
"Even though their dads are both rich, they're from two different worlds. Shane is a beer-and-shoot-a-deer kind of guy. Caroline could be plopped in the middle of Paris and do just fine."
He paused and rubbed at his cheek.
"The truth is, she left us both in the dust a long time ago."
"But that doesn't mean a guy has to give up trying," said Decker.
"No, it doesn't," said Kelly slowly. "But as the years go by, it is an effort with diminishing returns."
Decker wondered if Kelly was just talking about Shane or himself.
"Okay, that does not look good. It's like Hal Parker's place all over again."
Jameson said this as they pulled into the front of Dawson's house. The door was standing wide open. They hustled up to the porch. Kelly peered inside the doorway and called out,
"Hugh, everything okay?"
There was no answer. Kelly said,
"At this time of the night, all the hired help has long since gone home."
He pulled his gun and rushed inside. They drew their weapons and followed him in.
"Hugh," cried out Kelly. "Hugh, you here? Everything okay? Answer me."
They moved slowly down the hallway, taking time to clear each room before they passed by it. They heard nothing and saw no one. They finally reached the door to Dawson's office. It wasn't open, but Kelly tried the doorknob and found it unlocked. He tapped on the door.
"Hugh, it's Joe Kelly."
There was no answer. He turned the knob and slowly pushed open the door. They all looked into the room, their gazes moving from one section to the next until they stopped at the desk.
"Holy shit," exclaimed Kelly.
"Oh my God,"
echoed Jameson. Decker said nothing. He gingerly moved toward the desk, avoiding the obvious debris on the floor, and stared down at Hugh Dawson, or what was left of him.
The room had now taken on an electric blue shade for Decker as the pall of death cascaded all over the room.
I guess that sensation is going to continue to come and go, he thought.
It had been a particularly violent death. The man was slumped in his chair, with most of his head gone. The desk, chair, floor, and walls were covered with blood and bits of the deceased man. Kelly and Jameson joined him, taking care not to impact the crime scene. Decker ran his gaze down the weapon that had done this level of damage. The Remington side-by-side lay on the desk. It had been perched on top of a pile of books and then secured using masking tape. The muzzle was angled up and pointed at the dead man. Decker noted the line of string running from the triggers around the butt of the weapon and then back to where Dawson sat. There it dropped off the edge of the desk and into the knee hole. The man had apparently used the twine to pull the triggers, ending his life without a doubt. Decker examined blood and bits on the floor in front of the desk and on the sides. Kelly shook his head.
I can't believe this. First Stuart dead, and now Hugh?
Jameson managed to maneuver herself close enough to the desk to see a piece of paper lying there. It was covered with blood and other matter.
It's a suicide note,
she said in a hushed voice.
What does it say? Asked Decker.
It says he killed himself because he felt guilty for murdering Stuart McClellan.
None of them said anything for a long moment as this revelation sank in.
Does he give a reason for murdering the guy? Asked Kelly,
who was standing behind her.
No, just that he admits it and felt badly afterward.
They heard footsteps behind them. They all turned to see Caroline Dawson rush into the room. She looked around and then saw them by the desk. Her gaze reached her father's body and then moved to his destroyed face. Every muscle in her body tensed. She turned deathly pale, stopped moving forward, and screamed hysterically. A moment later, she tottered to the side and collapsed to the floor, unconscious, hitting her head on the side of the chair on the way down. And she didn't move after that. Chapter 68.
Kelly said, Caroline is going to be fine. They've checked her out. No internal bleeding, but she is concussed. They're just keeping her for observation. But it could have been a lot worse. She hit her head really hard when she fell.
He finished the cup of weak coffee he'd bought from the hospital cafe, tossed it in the trash, and sat down next to Jameson in the visitor's room. Decker was leaning against the wall. Kelly said,
We've showed the note to several of Dawson's associates. They said it looked like his handwriting.
I guess it's probably legit then, said Jameson.
So he blew his head off from guilt, muttered Kelly. I never would have believed he had anything to do with McClellan's murder.
Maybe Caroline will have some ideas about that.
I doubt she knew this was coming. You saw her reaction.
No, I meant whether she knew why her father would want to kill McClellan.
Right. Look, the guys have been business rivals for years. That's no secret. But that's all it was. Business. And why now? After they closed this big deal?
That's the $64,000 question, said Decker.
Well, I've got to do the paperwork on this back at the station, said Kelly.
And we'll go back out to the crime scene, replied Decker.
A moment later, Liz Southern walked in, looking breathless and distressed. She had on pale blue slacks, a dark brown blouse, and flat shoes. Her hair was tied up in a bun.
Is Hugh really dead?
I'm afraid so.
But how?
Looks like suicide, replied Kelly. He left a note.
Southern looked gobsmacked.
Why would Hugh kill himself?
We have to figure that out.
Why are you here? Asked Decker. And how did you know about Hugh?
Kelly said,
I called her and told her what had happened.
Where is Caroline? Is she going to be all right?
Said Southern.
Kelly said, She's in room 203. She's going to be fine, he added when Southern looked concerned.
Can I go and sit with her? I can't imagine what she must be going through.
I see no reason why you can't. She probably needs someone with her. In fact, that's why I called you.
Thanks.
She hurried off. After Kelly left, Jameson said,
Caroline is going to need more than a friend to see her through this. Seeing your father with his head missing, she's going to need therapy.
And lots of it, noted Decker. They left the hospital and drove back out to Dawson's house. Two cops were there on duty. One of the patrolmen told Decker and Jameson that a forensic tech was inside. They put on booties and gloves and entered the house. Dawson had not been moved. The tech was still taking pictures.
Messy, said the young man, who had identified himself as Ryan Leakey.
Shotgun blasts to the head usually are,
commented Jameson dryly. Decker walked around the perimeter of the room, taking it all in.
Reynolds has already been by,
said Jameson, looking at her phone.
He just texted me a prelim on the time of death. Based on body temp, he died about an hour before we got here.
Decker nodded.
That's important. It's a tight enough time frame to eliminate people from the suspect list.
He moved closer to the corpse and examined the end of the string dangling in front of the dead man.
You got pics of the desk yet? He asked Leakey.
Just one set.
Do multiple sets, including one from directly above. From as high a point as you can.
I got a ladder in my van outside.
Go get it.
Decker came around to the back of the desk and looked over the shoulder of the dead man. He eyed the weapon, the twine, and the position of the body. It all fit together, he had to admit.
See anything of interest?
Asked Jameson.
Yeah, a dead guy with no head, and it's too early for Halloween.
Decker looked down at the twine, and then squatted and studied the desk. He leaned in for a better look. He straightened and looked at the doorway as Leakey came in carrying a 10-foot ladder. Decker held it for him while Leakey climbed up it and took the pictures.
Measure the twine, too, said Decker.
The twine? Said the tech.
Yeah, the twine. I want to know exactly how long it is.
Jameson said,
Decker, what's going on? What are you thinking?
I'm not sure. Yet.
When the tech was done with the photos and the measurements, Decker crossed the room and sat in the same chair he had used when they had come to visit Dawson that first time. Jameson came to stand next to him.
Looks pretty straightforward, I guess,
she said.
Yeah, except it's always the straightforward ones that end up going sideways on you. And I still don't see how this gets us to the ticking time bomb.
I've been telling you that for a while now,
Jameson pointed out. When Decker didn't respond, she added,
Well, at least we don't have to ferret out the cause and manner of death on this one.
Don't we?
Replied Decker, staring resolutely at the dead man. Chapter 69
Caroline, why did you go out to your dad's house?
Asked Jameson. It was the following day, and she and Decker were in the woman's hospital room where the woman was lying in the bed, groggy and pale. Liz Southern sat silently in a chair across from her, gazing at her friend sympathetically. Caroline gazed up at Jameson and Decker, who hovered over her.
What?
Why were you at your dad's house?
Caroline closed her eyes and fell asleep. Southern said,
Let's step outside. She needs her rest. I think she was more concussed than they originally thought.
Out in the hall, Decker looked at Southern.
Hugh Dawson told us you and Caroline had become good friends, sort of like sisters.
Southern smiled.
I would be quite the older sister, but yes, we have become friends.
Her features turned somber.
When I heard about what happened, I couldn't believe it. The nurse told me they gave her some meds to help her rest. She didn't sleep all that much last night, apparently. They said she's probably in shock after what happened to Hugh.
Did you talk to her?
Asked Decker. Southern nodded.
Just for a few minutes, off and on.
Okay, then you know more than we do. What did she tell you?
From what I could understand, she went there to have it out with her father over some business issues. She didn't tell me what they were. That's right, you don't know,
said Jameson.
Don't know what? Hugh Dawson sold out to Stuart McClellan.